I think I just have to keep the time now, because I don't want us to end up without having, before the films, at least a little break. So we'll have to move on to Erhard's lecture. So I'll just introduce the last commentator, Erhard Schüttpelz. Thank you so much, Kalpana. This is Chaudhry. I'm really grateful for this, that you came to us tonight. Erhard is a collaborator of the house already for several years, and I'm glad you return here after 3 years where we started this Kanonfragen project, that the Lips project is, the Lips exhibition is part of this larger circle, and that you helped initiating here at the house. He's a media theorist and professor at the University of Siegen, and just for the sake of time, I won't introduce any of your many publications. You'll find them in the program. Welcome, Erhard.
Yeah, thank you. I take this mic, basically. Yeah, if I can, because then I can walk around, which is helping me a lot. Is that better? Sorry. Can I have this mic?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I'm here.
Wait.
Okay.
So wait a moment. Because I just. I'm glad to. I mean, these were really great talks. So it gave me lots of food for thought, and I just like to. Nevertheless, introduce the film, because it's, after all, about two films that we're going to see. But let me just go back to this moment also of where I started to get interested in this thing, and that was in New York. And it was at Columbia University when I sort of studied lately with Mick Tausig, and then rediscovered German anthropology, the anthropology of Fritz Kramer and many other people. And I discovered this will be most decisive moment for the rest of my life, that was in the 90s. It was a post-colonial moment, and the only person I didn't meet in New York basically was James Clifford. So going back to this, of course, for me it's different, because I mean, after all, I'm white, so this whiteness moment really overwhelms me too. And of course, I'm from a family that took part, at least on my father's side, in the last imperial effort of Germans to conquer the world. So, of course, it's a different biography, it's a different moment. Nevertheless, I think we do have a crucial heritage here in not only these films by Lips, these films by Rouge, but also in this exhibition by Lips and the whole project of not the reversed gaze, but anthropology in reverse, or what these people have tried to focus. So let me get back to, first of all, to this post-colonial question. I think in the literature you find two kinds of literature. So the historical literature on empires and the historical literature on post-colonial theory. And they are quite different, and there's a gap between. Because after all, the historical literature on empires stresses that empires were not based on us and them, they were based on intermediaries. So, for example, the great book by Frederick Cooper and Jane Burbank, it's all about empires, 1,000 years, but it's also about intermediaries in between the people at home and the people, of course, in the colonies, and in the colonies, of course, elites. You had to use intermediaries, and it was not one people governing another people, because there weren't basically these kinds of social conditions. So, in the post-colonial literature, of course, there's this us and them thing very, very strong. It was part of colonial ideology, but actually was not so much a question of colonial practice. Of course, racism played a crucial part in colonialism and imperialism, but it came in steps. So first of all, why is the mimetic racial body basically the other, and when does it happen? First of all, then Europe, of course, Europeans became Eurocentric only in the 18th century, basically on a very strong level, by conquering the world and by finding out that they had to do Eurocentrism. Here in Berlin, for example, people like Hegel. So before that, I mean, it's a real paradox. The whole of European education was in a continuity with antiquity. But when they really stopped and discontinued this continuity with antiquity, then they made antiquity into a fetish. Greece and Rome, we are all Europeans. So basically the practical continuity with ancient times was broken. And this is exactly when the period also when imitation becomes a problem, mimesis. Up to that point, of course, everybody was used to imitation as the basis of socializing and of becoming a social being and of being educated. But then imitation became a problem, and imitation also by children. Harvey Sachs, the inventor of conversationalism, said once, imitation is a problem for us because we say the children imitate us, but in fact they maybe are not imitating us. We're just saying that it's not legitimate what they are doing. And of course people in the colonies too. So imitation becomes a legitimation problem. Then the second step, I mean, just a very rough edge, the allochronism of evolutionism and so on only comes in the middle of the 19th century, and it of course separates Europe also from all the rest of the world in evolutionist terms. And then comes the racial body, so then you have the mimetic racial evolutionist body basically as the perfect other. And this is going on of course still, but it's only happening in the late 19th century. So we have a radical, we have an escalating movement. And it's not as old as the Greeks or the Romans, it's really a modern movement towards this asymmetrical situation in imperialism. And then the empires break apart. The empires never are basically organized like nation states. They never are organized as surveillance states because they are not, they cannot do it basically. It's also a financial problem. So when they break apart basically, then the post-colonial situation also the nationalist situation in Europe basically escalates, which is in the two world wars. So this is just for periodizing also basically this film, all these two films. The films were shot in 1954 and they were edited in 1957. This is the late colonial period. But you have to imagine these are only three or four generations of this kind of ideological frame of mind. It's not a question of centuries, it's a question of decades. And the anti-fascism and anti-authoritarianism of Lips, of course, too, which is in the 1930s. So going into this question of empire and nation states, of course, we have to make sure, we have to find out that nationalism and in a sense Hitler has won. So these ethnic, homogenized nation states only developed after World War II, and we are in the also with the Trump racism, we are basically in a situation that is a sequel to World War II, and the fission of empires. Empires are not nation states, but nationalism, of course, develops in the edges and in this double consciousness of nation state and empire in the European states. There are so many things to comment, and just by thinking of what whiteness means. We shouldn't forget, of course, whiteness is a precarious term in Europe and in the US too, until now after 1945, because obviously Jewish people were not white in a strict sense. They were whiteness of a different color. So we mustn't forget how many people were excluded from this minority of white, and of course of being civilized or not being primitive. Basically, people felt like a minority among in a sea and an ocean of otherness in the imperialist age. And this otherness, of course, was also interiorized as being in them. Psychoanalysis for us is a tool to understand this time, because many people in the academy at least believe in psychoanalysis, but psychoanalysis is part of it. Psychoanalysis saying the subconscious is the inner Africa. So the primitivism of psychoanalysis is basically the only key we have left in academic field to understand what primitivism was about, and being also about this split in the personality that people believed they had to experience in their racial bodies, in their authority structures, in their political legitimation. So it's a bit of a horror cabinet. We are entering it with this film. So, in film history, these films are unique because there are no films like those, and they don't have an equal in many terms. Les Maîtres Fous is the only film about a series of cults and movements, religious movements in sub-Saharan Africa. There were really literally hundreds of these kinds of movements between the early 19th century and the late colonial period. So there is no other film that shows these kinds of movements. And we wish we can even... I looked up the Maji Maji literature once. And then I found out, of course, there's a very strict and a very striking uncanny similarity between the beginning of the Maji Maji movement, because you really find that it was a prophetess. So there's a prophetess also in the beginning of the Hakka movement, or what was the Bori cult, and the Maji Maji rising. And in the literature, you find also that people enacted German soldiers in trance, so in spirit mediumship. So I have the suspicion, and I would love to know more about it, that at the beginning of the Maji Maji rising, there was also this Fremdgeister cult, or this foreign spirits cult. Of course, these spirits are not Europeans, and when they spoke German in trance, they were not Germans either. These spirits were supposed to be as old as the world, or as old as the other gods or spirits in the pantheon. So for us, of course, we see Europeans in them. But, of course, these are not cults for Europeans. The film, of course, as it is shot, is for us. But it was, of course, a way of dealing with the world on the local level and dealing with foreign powers overwhelming the imagination, but also the social constitution. And what we will see in Les Maîtres Fous, of course, then there are three kinds of spirits or three kinds of motifs. The one is military. So these movements of military personnel were so strange and so ugly that there is no comparison with the flowing movements of the other spirits, basically, that we unluckily don't see in the film. Then there's technology, so the movements of the cars, of locomotives, and then there's the coquettishness of women. So basically, these are three groups of movements that people found really, really strange. And of course, as we find out, also dogs were a bit of a fascination too, because the way Europeans dealt with dogs was totally perverse in comparison with African dogs. So the dog that is basically one of the centers of this film is for us, of course, something different than it is in other eyes. So, but I showed this film in the 90s, mostly in the early 2000s, many, many times. And then I also only showed Les Maîtres Fous first and then Jaguar second. For the first time today, we're going to see Jaguar first, which gives you the context of this post-colonial period. And it's a road movie. It's basically, these two films were shot on one voyage, when Jean Rouge made a sociological head from the French government, a sociological investigation, and was paid for it on the migrant workers from the French colony of Niger going to the Gold Coast and back again. So he wrote this report, a sociological report, but he also shot these films and the third one, Mami Vata. And he developed the motifs basically for the rest of his life with his friends that are in the film Jaguar, mostly Damery Zika and the others, and also the program for the whole of ethnography that came later. But there's a film, I might show an extract of that, it was shot in 1952, that is basically the matrix or the scenario for Les Maîtres Fous. It's a film about rainmaking, and it was shot in Niger. It shows the god of thunder, Dongo, in action. And it has exactly the same kind of disposition as Les Maîtres Fous. So if you see the films, and I don't have to show it because it's on YouTube. So whenever you want to go back after this evening and go on YouTube, you find this film under Yenendi with a Y, Yenendi, Les Hommes qui font la pluie. You find it immediately, and you can compare it with the Les Maîtres Fous. Because it is a film about the ritual. It also has the ritual structure. And it gives you the clue how Les Maîtres Fous was shot or then also edited. So there's a sacrifice, there's a dance or the trance dance. In the end, there's the thunder and there's rain coming. So Les Maîtres Fous is to be understood somehow. It's not my ideas, of course, but it's very specifically Fritz Kramer's idea that the indifference, this might, this power of the Hauka is not only linked to this god of thunder who accepted them, but it's also like a natural force. So like the rainbow, like the thunder, like the ocean, like the forces of the wilderness. And Rouge, by also, of course, talking to the people and finding out about these rituals, he sequentialized Les Maîtres Fous exactly like Les Hommes qui font la pluie or Yenendi. So you can really see that what is a natural force there, for us at least, rain making and thunder, is here applied to the Hauka as the spirits, the gods, whatever it is, of Western civilization. You know, documentary film in the post-World War II period, and this changed after 1989 radically, was understood to be an asymmetrical game. So people were not supposed to look into the cameras, and if people looked into the cameras, basically this was cut out of the film. So we have to imagine Rouge acted in a surrounding, at least for filmmakers, and anthropological filmmakers too, that was completely different from what we are used to now, after video and after basically this dogma of documentary film was broken. Rouge never accepted this dogma. So his background was surrealist, it was French, but it was also about disturbance. So he defended his method basically as feedback method, or as intervening first and then finding out what happens then. So in this manner, he developed fiction films by improvising with his friends and without a scenario, without a laid out plot, but just being on the road. Jaguar was the first. Jaguar was also a famous film in its time amongst filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard and Roberto Rossellini. In fact, Rossellini, as far as I know, developed his whole India project after looking at Jaguar. Godard wrote reviews, but Jaguar, by an accident, was not published or reached the public until 1967, because the Tonspur was damaged, so it had to be redone. When we watch this film, we have an accent of, you know, there's this memory of a situation. It starts with, do you remember when we went to Gold Coast as migrant workers? And of course, in 1967, that had a totally different meaning than in 1957. So the commentary was finished in 1957, but it had to be re-spoken in the 1960s. And when it was released in 1967, of course, then basically the whole colonial period was really gone. Whereas in 1957, it had a very concrete meaning, because Gold Coast was, after all, 1957, transformed into Ghana. So in the film, you see also scenes that are anachronistic. There's a scene from the independence of Ghana that is situated in the, it's a jump. So there are two surrealist cuts or jumps in one, each film there's one. The one is very famous in Les Maîtres Fous, it's this cut from the governor's sculptures to the real governor of the Gold Coast. So this is the surrealist cut that also Mick Tausig wrote about famously and wonderfully. And in 1957 film of Jaguar, you also find this time jump of jumping into independence and back again, which is also a surrealist jump in the time structure of this film. Both films deal with the same period, with the same situation, with the same people. And Rouge inserted a certain intersection of photos of stills in each film from each others, but he left out the religious aspects of migration in Jaguar and inserted, he left out basically the normal working routine and migrant work from Les Maîtres Fous, except for certain stills. So the Nouvelle Vague started with this film. It's only now acknowledged in also French film historiography that how much Rouge influenced early Nouvelle Vague, especially Godard, and not only by this film, but also by the film after Jaguar, which is Moi Noir, or Très Chouy, it was called in 1958, that really gives you a clue to Belmondo's acting in A Bout de Souffle or Breathless, that there is a direct sequel coming from the African films of Jean Rouge going into the Nouvelle Vague as a, and the city dandy thing that is in Jaguar goes directly into the early 60s of Godard's shooting with Belmondo. And I wanted to quote this in Latin now. Maybe you have to forgive my also German professor complex. Haben sua fata libelle, of course, this is what they say about books. Haben sua fata pellicule, which would be, they have their fates films, because Jaguar also basically missed its own fame. So now come back to this topic of anthropology in reverse, and there is basically no term to specify what this means. And in the literature, you find terms like anthropology in reverse, you find symmetrical anthropology, you find the reverse gaze, you find reciprocal anthropology, you find many things for this beast without a name. And can there be an anthropology in reverse? I believe, let's say, no. Because after all, anthropology, like all Western regimes of knowledge, is asymmetrical, it's one-sided. And the other side of anthropology would maybe not be science. Maybe it would be art. But even art, of course, is a Western regime of thought. So what would an anthropology in reverse be like? Basically, I think the question of gaze, of course, leads us into this, into error and mistakes. Because as we heard, gaze is not what anthropology in reverse can be about. It has very much to do with this question of the intermediary situation. If we think of the postcolonial literature, which is, of course, fascinated with topics like mimicry, but also hybridity and surveillance and discourse, then I think we miss what these things are about. These films basically that we're going to see are about migrant workers. So they are about intermediary situations and intermediaries. So they are about people who have to think on both sides of their divide, on many, many sides of the colonial situation. So there is no us and them for them. And we see that also very clearly in Jaguar, because they go through these boundaries of the colonial situation and they change from one setting to another. So they have their othering too. So you'll find out that they go through a bush and then they see people living in the bush. And of course, they also have this befremden of being in a totally situation that they don't understand. So the intermediary situation is very much about reversals. It's about categorizations that apply from both sides or from many sides, but also always in a difference. And Lips, of course, book is also about this kind of intermediary situation more than we think. I make it very, very blunt. When Europeans thought, okay, the others are savages or they are primitives, they behave like children, or isn't this mad what people are doing? Of course, this is what people thought about the whites all the time. After all, the whites were for many people in this world children, like children, or behaving like children, like irresponsible children most of the time. They were like madmen, of course, with their technology, with their military movements, with their strange way of behaving and their strange authority that they assumed they had. And they were, of course, like savages. I mean, being brutal, being military, and being irrational. So the categorization of these Victorian primitive terms, dealing with madness, being with children, being like children, being savages, or being uncivilized, help us a lot more to understand what anthropology in reverse is about, or was about at least, than the gaze question. Because these categories are not only universal, I believe at least, but then some of the consequences are always there. And they were, of course, heavily implanted in people's minds, but not only in the colonialist mind and the racist mind, but also in, of course, everybody's children's minds to know what a civilized being is, how civilized being behaves, and what madness is, where madness lies, and how deranged people can behave and how criminal things can get. So this is, I think, what this is the firm basis of anthropology in reverse in the colonial period and also being going back to the Columbian exchange, but even going further, that you find, of course, people categorizing each other in these elementary terms of being something irresponsibly other. The people who follow this motive, we've mentioned two of them, Lips and Rouge so far, I think they have one thing in common. If we go through it, Lips, after all, is a man who is a troublemaker. He was had made trouble and he had trouble wherever he was. Rouge was a troublemaker too. He was lucky. And of course, he was a great inventor. He was a playful master and, of course, a master of his playfulness. But also, he was an amateur in many, many respects. He was the inventor of the handheld camera, we shouldn't forget. So he was really an inventor too. But also, he was a bit of an oddball in this French anthropology. Then I have to mention one big school of anthropology, and astonishingly now that I'm in Berlin, this is the Berlin School of Anthropology of the 1970s and 80s. And some of them are here, and I've learned a lot from them. So I have to mention, of course, Fritz Kramer, Heike Behrendt, Thomas Hauschild, Bernhard Streck, Marin Trenk, Richard Rottenburg, Michael Habsmeier, and I hope I haven't forgotten anybody. But even this was a bit of an oddball moment in the history of anthropology, we must say, because they are the only people who developed this motive of Lips as a school or as an informal clique. And it was gone, in a sense, after 1989, and I still wonder why. So when this motif was rediscovered by German anthropology, also following up on Lips, it was still in the Cold War, it was still in this glass jar, basically, that the Cold War had überstülpt us on the situation, the political situation, and was, of course, here in Berlin, also in a bit of an isolated but also special place of radicals, of adventures, and of illusions. And because I was in Columbia University with Mick Tausig, I have to say, okay, Mick Tausig also didn't have a school, he didn't have any disciples, so he developed this motif also as a maverick, or think of somebody like Roy Wagner. So if you go through the list of anthropology in reverse, people who really radicalized this motif, you find a whole list of isolated or maverick people. Oh, some people are laughing here, it's good to hear, but you have to wonder why. And I still do. So somehow, of course, anthropology in reverse cannot be a method. It cannot be a school. It cannot be a paradigm. It cannot even be a subject. It's something that creeps in the interstices of other things. Because even if you think of somebody mentioning more, Hortense Powdermaker, the first media anthropologist, who worked in the south of the USA on racism, and then in Hollywood, but also somebody like Bruno Latour, you always find the singularizing moment. So the singularizing experience that lies in this motive or in finding out about the other in this symmetrical, reciprocal manner somehow has to be built into this project. And of course, you find it in Rouge, that things become unique once you think on both sides of these strong categorizations of sociality, of race, and of culture. This is a serious thing. And of course, it's a laughing matter. Because after all, Bronislaw Malinowski wrote the preface to The Savage Hits Back, and he wrote these words, that anthropology is the science of the sense of humor. And there was this moment today when humor was mentioned, and the humor, Wittgenstein said, humor was killed in the Third Reich. Humor was killed in National Socialism. And it's much more than only that something funny is killed. It's a form of life. It's an atmosphere of life that is killed. So Lips somehow restored it with The Savage Hits Back. So I think it's true. There is this killing of humor in fascism, which is a farce, after all. That's why you're not supposed to laugh. if you look at fascism, of course, the way people dress, the way people move, even the military movements, and so on, they are farcical. That's why humor has to be killed first, because it is, after all, they could be laughed off stage. This is, I think, what is there in Lips. So coming from this terror and fearing for his life by fleeing from Cologne, he lived around the corner, basically, where I live. That's why Lips is very close to my heart. So I live exactly where Lips lived. Lives in the same quarter in Cologne. He wrote this book in a moment of ambiguity and of saying goodbye to it all in this kind of gesture. So what is it? It's a figurative thing. There is no literal sense one can make of anthropology in reverse. It will always be a kind of artful, figurative moment in wherever it appears. If you look through the history of the Lettres Persanes or the even Montaigne's famous aphorisms on cannibals, because that came to my mind first, because it was also what happened there when Montaigne tried to defend the cannibals. It is, on the one hand, a cosmological problem, even if you do just one sentence like talking about cannibals, because the cannibalism of question, of course, is linked with the Eucharist. So that was not Eurocentrism, that of course was Christocentrism, when Montaigne developed this motif that Lévi-Strauss came back and back again to. And of course, Viveros de Castro, the whole business of Viveros de Castro is a sequel to this question of cannibal metaphysics, as we all know. So it's a difficult balance, and I'd like to quote Fishley and Weiss at this moment. When anthropology in reverse happens and it succeeds, then it's only das Schönste ist das Gleichgewicht kurz bevor es zusammenbricht. We should understand this sentence not as a, am schönsten ist es, wenn es das Gleichgewicht da ist, bevor es zusammenbricht, sondern as a definition. Das Schönste ist the balance that is there before it breaks down. This fragile balance between, or an equation that cannot be. An equation between conceptual categorizations on both sides that do not equal, and they will never equal. So take this Fishley and Weiss sentence as a definition, and because I think this will be the strongest home I want to hammer home tonight, this is where I should stop. Thank you.
So rather than having a discussion right now, I'll say we'll have it in between and after the films. So that we all get a little break, which I think is necessary, both for food and drink intake and for fresh air. Thanks so much, Erhard, for this, for sharing your myriad thoughts in such clarity and without even going back to your notes.